Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, the second of two episodes in conversation with Canberra-based poet Melinda Smith, plus The Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. I'm Peter Searles. Melinda Smith's several poetry collections include Drag Down to Unlock or Place an Emergency Call, which won the 2014 Prime Minister's Literary Award. Among her other books are Goodbye Cruel, Pitt Street Poetry, 2017, the chapbook Listen Bitch, with artist Karen Florence, Recent Work Press, 2019, and Manhandled, also from Recent Work Press in 2020. She frequently collaborates with artists in other disciplines, including visual artists, and is a former poetry editor at the Canberra Times. Last week, we ended by asking Melinda Smith about her project Members Only, which involved working with words and signs displayed around Old Parliament House. It was a collaboration with visual artist and poet Karen Florence. We asked her about such collaborations and then about her playful approach to using words.
How does collaborating with Karen help you see your own poetry? Or does it?
Well, it kind of does. Like, I like to play visual games with things, but I'm actually really shit at designing things and making things look good. And Karen, that's her language, you know. She also, though, is a poet, and she has produced books of visual poetry and other, and she's written poems as well. So she speaks more of my language probably than I do of hers, in a way. But we were just introduced by a mutual friend many years ago, and it's almost hard now. I feel like I should have called her up and had a chat to her before this. It's hard now to remember how we just started working together. But this is one of the first times that we actually kind of made it a project, and we said, okay, let's do this and let's make this happen. But ever since then, we're both quite a similar age, and we just have a similar take on the world, and we really enjoy the give and take of collaborating. And I'm terrible with deadlines and producing things. If you give me forever to do something, I will take forever to do it. But when you're collaborating, you have to have like a way of fitting into the other person's practice. And mm-hmm. So it's much more like having a work colleague, and you have meetings and you make progress and you have points where you have to produce things by. And I find it really lovely. And I have collaborated with other folks in other disciplines, but Karen and I suppose we just keep coming back around, and we are going to do some more. We're going to go and play in the cabinet papers of the Howard years soon, because in 2027, all of the cabinet papers will be available finally from the Howard years. And we want to do some other fun found text manipulation, political commentary, slightly feminist kind of stuff around that. We haven't done playing together yet, but it's a very fruitful, creative relationship.
We've mentioned the text manipulation, which is another feature of your writing, and you seem to use all sorts of tools and approaches to that. Maybe you could say something about that.
I'd love to. So I've been doing, playing with text for a very long time, but mostly I first used to do just anagram poems. I just found it fun to take a word and see if I could write a poem about that concept, just using the letters in that word. And when I discovered sometime in, maybe 2012, I think when I was writing the autism book, I discovered the internet anagram server, which means you can type in a word and it generates all the anagrams it can possibly generate in a second, and you don't have to spend 3 weeks with a pen and paper and racking your brain for different anagrams of the same word. So I found that quite freeing and quite exciting. And I do have, this strand in my practice where I like writing with other people's words. It's not the same kind of poem that you write when you are tearing your beating heart and nailing it onto a page, but but I often find it can, because of the random nature of it and because it kind of approaches nonsense, it can stick together ideas you would never think to stick together, and it can, some illuminations and serendipitous kind of insights can result from that. So I always like to keep that textual play as part of my practice. And other things I do, and this is kind of, it's more done in the States. It's not as common a practice here, but the young people are starting to get on board with it. It's just erasure poems. So you take a text that you want to, talk back to or enter in some kind of conversation with, and you erase bits of it or enhance bits of it or you know, make it into a different text, but it's all about the conversation with that text. So an example of that would be, you know, in Manhandled and Listen, Bitch, I took an apology that was really a sorry, not sorry. It was a statement. It wasn't even an apology that Don Burke wrote when accused of wrongdoing at Channel 9 in a Me Too kind of context. Mm. And the public statement he wrote about that, I edited slightly so that it said some other things. And I told Shane Strange, publisher at Reason Work Press, what I had done and said, this might be get you into trouble. And he said, no, that's fine. We'll see what happens. Mm. And it's not like Don Burke or his people read poetry right. books. So it's nobody's come after us yet. And we've not done anything. I've just used his own words, just edited a few of the ones in between out. Mm. And then kind of going on, I have discovered other text manipulation tools and techniques, and a lot of these are now available as kind of apps or, there's websites online you can go to. There's one called the Language is a Virus Textual Manipulation homepage, and you can go there and you can get any number of text manipulation tools. So you can enter in a piece of text and it will just randomly take out, you know, every seventh word or something. You can specify the parameters, or you can say, you know, switch all the nouns to verbs, or splice these two bits of text together. And I often do that with, I have a piece of text that makes me angry and I have a Bible verse and I kind of stick them together and see what happens. And you often get very strange effects when you do that. So, yeah, I just find it creatively interesting. I find the results interesting. A lot of the work with that kind of practice is really just knowing when what you've got is interesting and when what you've got is just something to go in the bin. I suppose it's the same as writing every poem, but yeah. But I won't ever stop playing with that stuff because it helps me get out of my own head a lot too as a poet. I think it's important to have more than one way to get inspired.
Mm.
Yeah.
And is there an example of a poem that's written in that sort of style that you could read?
Yes. I might do a very early one, Autism Crumpets. this is from a book called First Then, one of the very first books that Arts ACT helped me write by providing some funding so that I could have some time to write it. And it's a book about autism. And again, it looks at it from lots of different perspectives, and this poem takes the word autism spectrum, which you can also read as autism crumpets if you rearrange just one half of it, and does a bunch of anagrams of autism spectrum in order to kind of talk about the experience of autism from outside and from inside. Autism crumpets. I should say before I start, I do have an autistic family member and I've spent a lot of time in that world. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean I necessarily understand everything about what it's like, but I have tried to use my compassion and empathy as I can. Autism crumpets. Static me rumpus. Imp tutu screams. Mute. Strums. Pika. That's the thing where you eat things that aren't food, like paper. Mute, strums, pika. Eat up. Mmm. Ticks are us. Mute, Mac purists. Miscast erupt. Up came mistrust. Rips mum acutest. Impact. Muse rust. Tacit summers up, captures its mum. Sure must impact. Must impact user. Mum stirs teacup.
I think what strikes me about your work is that you have this ability to do very interesting things with the line or the place in the poem while at the same time still serving the larger picture, like in this case. So I just wanted to make sure. So Ginninderra Press put this one out.
Yes.
And this was an early one, you said. So the year was
2012 or 13.
2012.
Yep. There we go. So I wrote it in 2011. And yes, thanks to Ginninderra Press, because they were my first publisher.
The other thing that strikes me is what a wide range of topics you cover. One of the things I really marvel at, so I was reading through Drag Down to Unlock or Place an Emergency Call. And one of the things I struggled with early on when I was writing was how to put a book together. But maybe it's with Karen's influence at times, but this book is put together in such an interesting way, right? Where the sections are uploads, downloads, and then news, sport, and weather, right? So, it's got this very purposeful kind of metaphoric organization that allows, I think, a lot of room for the poems to come under. How did the idea for this one come?
So this one, and this is a Pitt Street poetry book, so you can see I'm quite publisher agnostic, although I'm quite happy at Recent Work Press now. This one, Alan Gould called this one a paper smartphone, and I think he's right, because the front of it has got Drag Down to Place to Unlock or Place an Emergency Call. And before we had the word swipe, it used to say Drag Down on lots of devices. So that was the smartphone that I had at the time that I was writing this book in kind of 2012, 2013 had that as its kind of home screen message, Drag Down to Unlock or Place an Emergency Call. And so the sections are named after the sorts of things that you might see on your phone, uploads, downloads, news, sport, and weather. But the themes of the book are about child, like being pregnant, having kids, child rearing, everything that comes with it. So the kind of uploads were actually, I don't know why I put them at the beginning of the book, but they're about death, thinking about people being uploaded back into the cloud.
Yeah.
And downloads are about birth, whereas the idea is you're getting a new person from the cloud and putting them into the world. And then news was, I suppose, just kind of bigger picture poems. Some of them had like political commentary. Some of them about space, that sort of stuff. Sport was actually about sex, and weather was actually about weather. This is the first book of mine to get any attention on a kind of national level. This is the one that won the only thing I've ever won, apart from second place in that poetry contest I told you about earlier, the Prime Minister's Literary Award for Poetry in 2014. And I've been, trading on this ever since, so to speak. But this book took about 10 years to write, because it was basically everything I had been writing and keeping and writing and keeping from about 2003 forwards to, 2012, 2013, when I kind of put the book together. So it spans a very long period in my practice. It's, I suppose, because of that, I would call it quite an uneven book, but I suppose the child-rearing, child-bearing poems are all written roughly in the same mood and at the same time. So that is its cohesive, that's the core of it, I suppose. Mm. Yeah.
I find those poems so interesting, because I think sometimes now in the 21st century, this gets written about. Mm. But considering how long women have been giving birth, I think that's pretty recent. Mm. And I think they could do maybe a better job with that, because that's how we're all here, right? Mm. Mm. And the short poem, Heracles' Other Labor, sort of addresses that.
Mm. This is, again, it's got a joke title. Heracles, or Hercules, is famous for having had 12 jobs to do, which were called the 12 labours of Hercules. But labour is also a word for what we do when we give birth. So I call this Heracles' Other Labour, and it's about his birth and about his mother, who is Alcmene. And because this is the kind of book this is, it's also an acrostic. It has Alcmene down the side. So each line commences with a letter, and if you spell out the word that results, that goes down the left-hand side of the page, you get Alcmene. So it's an acrostic on her name. Heracles' Other Labour. A lot of us know tales of Heracles labouring 12 labours for renown. Known less, his pregnant mother Alcmene's majestic childbed feet. Though she bore down, Eilithyia, birth goddess, crossed her knees, 9 nights of heaving hell until he crowned. Epic. But who sings of deeds like these?
And that's that last line, right?
Who sings?
Reading this, when I got to the word epic, it actually made me laugh.
Yeah.
Because it is cheeky.
It is cheeky. It's epic, and it's like epic, but also epic, man, dude, epic. Yes. Sometimes things just happen like that.
Melinda Smith's poetry does make you laugh at times, but her humour has another purpose. It claims agency against wrongs or slights. It's a way of saying get stuffed, but nicely.
Possibly say get stuffed nicely, and like, isn't it ridiculous we find ourselves in this situation at all? Mm. Can't we all just love each other? But yeah, also, yeah, you're right. It is an attempt to take back some kind of agency in the face of things that can't be changed or can't be changed for a long time or something like that. That might be a way of viewing the humour element. Yeah.
On this week's episode of Poetry on the Radio, and last week's, our guest has been Canberra-based poet Melinda Smith. Next week on the program, our visitor will be Castlemaine, Victoria-based poet Ross Donlan. For the rest of this episode, we'll listen to Melinda Smith speaking at the recent symposium Poetry as Innovation Machine, hosted by University of Canberra's Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, and organised by our host at Poetry on the Radio, Kimberly K. Williams. In the presentation, Melinda talks about the use of machine-generated writing prompts in her work.
One of the very early games I started to play was with the Internet Anagram Server, which is great fun for a rainy afternoon. Now, anybody can make an anagram out of a string of letters, but it takes time, thought, a dictionary, lots of pieces of paper and pencils and crossing out. Or you can go to the Internet Anagram Server and you can type in your word, click a button, and you have thousands of anagrams at your disposal. So once I learned about this, I took my existing anagram practice and turbocharged it. Here's an example of something I generated with the Internet Anagram Server. It's they're all anagrams of the word parliament, so the poem is called Parliament. Partial men. Male in, part man, part lie. Rampant lie. Rant, lie, map, lie, ma, pant. Mantra pile. Real man pit in a trample. Armpit lane. Latrine map. I arm planet. I mar planet. Man at peril. Remap at nil. I would never have been able to come up with that poem without the Internet Anagram Server, because it did the grunt work for me. And so that's one reason why we might innovate with machines in coming up with our poetry, is that it just makes everything that you might want to do go a lot quicker. So they're instruments in that kind of way of using them. So think about the machine as the help. Another way of using the machine is to kind of engage with the machine-mediated world that we live in by making poems that look a bit like search results or that are inspired by search results. That goes back at least to the 90s in the States. There was a whole kind of poetry genre called Google Sculpture, where people would put weird search terms into Google and write poems with the search results that popped out. And I did one search from searches through Hansard, which is kind of part of the same project that birthed that Parliament poem. And here's an example of, in November 1962, I had a particular reason to find the word silence. I wrote down what the search results were because they made a strange poem of their own. What you get when you search for silence. One of his colleagues has gone into a significant silence to silence us, but this is having no effect. Listen in silence, spoken and heard in silence. The Prime Minister has observed an unusual silence on this matter.
There was an old Australian play written many years ago called The Silence of Dean Maitland. The Honourable Member talked about The Silence of Dean Maitland. The silence of Arthur Colwell is the more remarkable aspect of this matter. I received a certain amount of ridicule and a certain amount of scorn by silence. There is a period of awful silence while research is carried out and the soldier continues out of the silence into which he has preferred to enter. I am also conscious of the silence, that there was silence. That is the answer about the £10,000. So that's another kind of excursion into that machine-mediated space to make art out of the experiences that make up our lives. One final example I might give you is, because this kind of plays into where we're going next, is a poem I wrote with the predictive text function on my mobile phone, which is another game a lot of us like to play. So you just start a sentence, I am, I started, and then you take the middle word that comes up on the suggestions consistently until you get to the end, and then you keep going with another kind of text string. So my predictive text thinks I need affirmations. I am a beautiful person. I will be in the morning. I will be in the morning. I will be in the morning, and I am having trouble viewing or clicking on these sites. I have a few hours of the most part. If I could do that to you and the go-ahead, I will be in the morning. We moved in. I will not only did. The first one to the go, I will be in the morning. The wall. And because autism is a great truth, I will be in the morning. So thinking about that predictive text, which is a thing that's quite familiar to us all now, getting slightly technical but not too technical because I'm not smart, one of the things that drives predictive text is something called a Markov chain, where it works out what character or what chunk of text is most likely to follow the chunk of text that you've given it based on learning from a bunch of previous inputs. And the use of that to mess around with poetry goes back a long, long, long way. Even if you just limit it to Australia, John Tranter was doing this 40 years ago with a program called Breakdown. So he documented all his experiments and fed it things like Matthew Arnold poems or other modernist works. And it got very good at spitting out a lot of nonsense with a few chunks that sounded a bit like Matthew Arnold or a bit like modernists. I think, who was he doing? John Ashbery. So then John Tranter would get involved in cleaning up the output. He'd spend a lot of time working out what the input was going to be and working with the computer program about what the text chunk size was going to be. And then he would spend hours cleaning up the output. So again, you have a poet using a machine, but just as a helper in order to do things to text and then, working with the output. So why might you do that? You know, why was John Tranter doing that? Why am I still doing that now? Why are millions of other poets doing that all over the place? They save time, of course. We've talked about that. But it's just really another assisted way to make things new, bring forth the unexpected and connect the hitherto almost unconnectable. And also, you know, part of that helping to comment on the world that we live in. Charles O. Hartman wrote in his book Virtual Muse, Experiments in Computer Poetry, that the central question isn't exactly whether a poet or a computer writes the poem, but what kinds of collaboration might be interesting. And he also went on to say, you know, in this game, this dance between the poet and the text and the reader, a properly programmed computer has a chance to slip in some interesting moves. So it's all about that element of the unexpected, that surprise that we as humans like from our poetry. And all of the things that we've just talked about rely on feeding the machine a corpus of text, generally quite limited and targeted. And there's, you know, other more advanced mechanisms available. There's a beautiful thing called glass leaves made by Hera Lindsay Bird and Gregory Can that we that I often use in my work. And there's a whole website, the Language is a Virus Text Manipulation Portal, which has, you know, any machine-assisted text manipulation technique you could poke a stick at. Some of them are just sped-up techniques that go way back to Dada in the 20s, sped-up cut-ups or sped-up random obliteration of text. But some of them rely on things like Markov chains and other processes that you need an algorithm for. So, you know, there's a lot of this material out there, but most of that hitherto has relied on feeding it something. Now, however, we have things like ChatGPT and other neural networks which have already been pre-fed. They've been pre-fed a very large chunk of the internet, and they use that to learn the patterns. So when you come to them, they produce things that you might not expect. One of the problems, of course, with that is the selection of their diet. What voices are in that diet? What voices are outside that diet? That's a very big question that people are still arguing about and will be arguing about for a long time. But are we getting closer to the point where an AI might actually just write a poem? And I've been thinking about this for a long time. I think I was on a panel in 2015 at Queensland Poetry Festival when I first had to grapple with these issues. My personal view is the origin of the creative impulse in humans is self-awareness plus an awareness of mortality. So monkey gonna die, if you will. If or when computers become self-aware, they may also have this realization, motherboard gonna fry, something like that. So perhaps then they might start to make what we understand as art on their own. Would it be art we could understand? Can we see a future for poetry without human readers? If a bot writes a poem and no human reads it, is it still a poem? Think about those. I still don't know the answer to those questions.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, August 21 at Smith's Alternative in Civic at 7:30, That Poetry Thing presents Andrew Menken and Sarah McLeod, plus open mic. Andrew Menken often writes about his hometown of Budgerowy on the Central Coast. He was awarded the 2021 Allen and Unwin Award for Creative Writing. Canberra-based Sarah McLeod explores stylistic boundaries and what it means to be a child in the 21st century. This month at Manning Clark House Poetry, Anne Benjamin, Carmel Summers, and an open mic. Anne Benjamin is a Sydney-based writer with strong Indian connections. Her books include Gemstones, an anthology of short-form poetry written in collaboration with seven international poets, and a monograph on the Gospels written largely in poetry. Carmel Summers is a Canberra-based poet with an interest in a wide variety of forms. Her collaborative poetry book, The Last Day Before Snow from Malacorn Publications in 2016, was awarded the ACT Publishing Award in 2017. The evening will begin with an open mic celebrating spring. Bring a poem, yours or someone else's, to read about spring. That's on Thursday, August 24, from 7 p.m. at the Manning Clark House, 11 Tasmania Circle in Forest. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded First Nations country in the studios of Art Sound FM, and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays, and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Sounds and Sweet Airs by English trumpeter Ian Carr. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.